Thank you. So appropriate to the title, we're going to start off with frogs. The problem that I want to talk about, the research and theoretical problem that I want to talk about, that has its origins experimentally in the 1960s. And the question, and the gentleman who articulated this first clearly and then did the experiment that tested this concept that I'm going to talk about was John Gurdon. So if you wanted to learn more about the experiment and what he did, this is John Gurdon, and there's a series of papers in the 1960s. He's from Cambridge, England. He was a young faculty member at Cambridge, England at the time, and did a very useful and insightful experiment with frogs. And I'm at a tremendous disadvantage because I can't draw a frog on the board. So I attempted to draw the precursor of a frog, which is a tadpole. But I don't think that's what a tadpole looks like either, so it doesn't matter. Gurdon realized something, partly because of measurements made by a variety of embryologists in a series of developmental steps. You start off with an egg, and then you fertilize the egg, and you have then the amount of DNA that is the starting material that has the information to make a whole organism, in this case, to make a frog. So the information is in the DNA that's translated into a series of messenger RNAs, that an intermediate that copies, it's just a copy of the DNA, and then it's translated into proteins on ribosomes. And it's those proteins that assemble into making all of the different tissues of a frog. They make, I'll constantly contrast for you today, brain and liver. So they make the brain of the frog with neurons, this particular cell type, and the liver of the frog with liver cells, which is a very different cell type. And it's manifestly clear, it was clear at the time, that the genes that express themselves to make the proteins and the proteins that were in the brain were different than those in the liver. And another quandary was that when liver cells divide, they divide to give rise to liver cells. And when brain cells divide, they early on in development, they give rise to brain cells, to neurons, right? So that this differential expression of the genes in the DNA had an inherited pattern, right? And so rather quickly, there were two formulations of the possibilities to get there. One was you started off with all of the information. You went through a series of developmental steps to get to a tadpole, let's say, right? And that in the brain cells were the 60% of the information, the DNA was pared down to just that information to make neurons. And in the liver, it was pared down to just that information to make liver cells, in which case you would have an inherited form of the liver and the brain. But clearly then, the brain and the liver cells could never go back and forth in any way, simply because they didn't even have the information to make the other tissue. Right. And so that was one hypothesis. And the second hypothesis was that there was some way to shut down a portion of the DNA so that it never made messenger RNA, so that it never made proteins. And this, oddly enough, would be inherited. Right? The shutting down process had to be inherited because brain cells made brain cells and not liver cells and so forth. Right? And so Gurdon wanted to test this idea. And the way he tested it was pretty ingenious. The first thing he did was he took an egg. So this is a non-fertilized egg. And he learned how to remove the nucleus of the egg, right? He actually did it by radiation. So you could do a very fine pin of radiation, ultraviolet radiation, onto the nucleus would degrade, and then you just had an egg without a nucleus, right? So clearly you've just removed all of the information to make the frog. And then he said, okay, if it's true that a frog has in its nucleus from a liver cell or a brain cell all the information to make a frog, I will take, and he took skin, right? I will take the nucleus of the cell and transplant it back into the egg, right? Now, this is an interesting experiment because there's now no need to fertilize it, because in the frog, it had the copies that came from the grandparents, the mother and the father, right? So what's really quite interesting is that if he could make a whole frog here, it would be the son of the grandparents, right? And that would be a way to say that you have all the information you need to make brain cells and liver cells in the skin cell of a frog, right? So that was his test, right? And everybody agreed this was a brilliant way to ask this question, and he chose frogs because they're very malleable for this kind of experiment. Let me say, this experiment was done, the bigger publicity was gotten in the 80s and 90s when Dolly the sheep was cloned this way, right? So that, there was an udder cell that was taken, the nucleus was put into the egg of a sheep. That was implanted back, so frogs develop in the sea, right, in seawater, so you could develop the eggs outside. Dolly had to be implanted back into a mother, and then the mother gave birth, and Dolly was a clone of the grandparents, of the mother, right? So it's really a little, it's interesting sort of conceptual idea about it's cloning. And actually nowadays, people pay, I think, something like in Texas especially, $10,000 to clone their dog, so that when their dog has died, you can clone it and have the same dog again. And quite interestingly, it doesn't actually turn out to be exactly the same dog, which tells you what is genetically determined and what's environmentally determined. So it's quite, there are many interesting things about this experiment that are quite good. It's even been rumored that people have tried this, but it's never been reported for obvious reasons, I think. Yes. Okay, so this experiment actually, when first done, didn't work. So you could ask the question, why? I mean, I think Gurdon must have been devastated when it didn't work, because he did the experiment because he was so sure that all of the information would be here, right? And all you had to do was just run it through the system and then you get it back. But it didn't work. But Gurdon thought about it a little bit, and then he did a series of other experiments which were quite interesting. He passed the nucleus into other eggs, right? So he's not only taking the nucleus from the skin of a tadpole and putting it back in an egg, he leaves it there for 24 hours. And then he takes it back out and puts it in another egg. He leaves it there for 24 hours, takes it out and puts it in another egg. So this is a concept that I'll just call reprogramming, right? And you go from egg to egg because there are enzymes that reprogram, catalysts that change the program, right? And they're most efficient in the egg, and they run downhill as they work. So you're reprogramming, and then by the third egg, he did the experiment, and it worked. He got a tadpole, right? So that left him with two conclusions that were quite interesting. One is, it's rather clear that all the cells of your body, with there are some exceptions, that your immune system recombines DNA, your somatic DNA. So it's not quite the way it started. But other than taking your lymphocytes, but take any other cell, and you could do this experiment, and you would, with reprogramming, you would actually clone the individual. So we don't lose any genetic information over through development. Yeah.
Why are three different eggs,
yeah,
in 24 hours each,
yeah,
different from one egg
for 48 hours or 72 hours?
Yeah.
I think that I can only speculate because nothing was ever done to really prove this. But the activities declined with time, and that's just because of the egg really not being in optimal conditions. It's like, you know, if you incubate an enzyme at 37 degrees, its activity will decline with some time, right? So I think that's probably, it's an enzymatic reaction. You'll see why in a minute. I'll get to the molecular basis of this in a minute. Yes?
How did it fail?
It failed by not making... It actually didn't even get to the stage of making a blastocyst. It failed quickly.
But it didn't divide.
It didn't divide, actually.
It didn't divide.
No. He could show that. He then realized that there was something else beside the genetic information that made a brain cell, and a liver cell, and it was an inherited something. So the term came up called epigenetics. And so the term got coined that it was not genetic because the genes are the same. It was epigenetic because there was liver cells make liver cells and brain cells make brain cells, so it had an inherited quality, but it was epigenetic. It wasn't quite genetic. Now, and what you're doing is you get an epigenetic state that makes a skin cell a skin cell, and this deprograms the state, and then you're reprogramming it to make an animal again, right? That's the concept that was on the table. Today we actually understand the chemical basis of that programming. So let me just to satisfy you a little bit without going into too much chemistry, let me just say DNA, this is DNA, right, which is in the nucleus and is made up of four letters, A, T's, G's, and C's, the sequence of which contains information, and the information it contains is to make a protein, right? That's a gene. One gene, one protein, the information, right? It turns out that you'd expect at a frequency of 1 in 16, the letter C, G, right? And so the letter C, the dinucleotide C, G occurs in the DNA. Now actually, the first tip-off that this is a little bit special, this is a more than just a random set of dinucleotides, is that instead of occurring in a random way at 1 in 16, it actually occurs in your body in 1 in 160 times. Right, so it's tenfold lower frequency than normal, and that is statistically out of the distribution completely. Right? Secondly, sometimes you get a CG where the C is methylated, right? And that's called a methylated mark, right? On the opposite strand, because base pairing is GC, right? So this has a polarity, right? And when you get a methylated CG on one strand and a new DNA strand is replicated, you get CG. And then there's an enzyme that comes along, sees the methylated CG, and what does it do? It methylates this C, right? Now that means that the new strand is inheriting a pattern found on the old strand, right? And it's not the sequence that's important, it's the methylation that's important. And it turns out that methylated CGs, when they occur in large numbers, shut the whole chromosome down. Shut the region down, you get no messenger RNA, you get no protein, right? So now you can sort of have a feel for the epigenetic signals. The epigenetic signals are marking the DNA. And what's quite interesting is, as you make sperm and as you make eggs, all these signals are erased. Right? So that's interesting. In the egg, almost all the CG methylation signals are erased, so you start at zero. And then you lay in a program which constantly turns off parts of the chromosomes, and you can mark those by this methylation site, right? Now, it's a little more complicated than this. There are also some proteins involved that are methylated. They're also changed in other ways, but that isn't the important thing. This is a good example of a methylated mark that is part of programming development, right? Now, that this is important for inherited basis of tissue specificity can be found in just listing some diseases where the methylation is improper, right? So this methylation changes with time in the brain. And not having the proper methylation in the brain, you have cognitive abnormalities and you can have behavioral abnormalities, right? So there are children born who don't have that proper methylation, and they behave in different ways. There's some diseases which have never been proven, but speculation is that parts of schizophrenia are like this. That's a behavioral trait. Loss of memory can be like this, and so forth. Right? Actually, even diet can change some of these methylation groups. So there are environmental impacts on the methylation. And the one I'm going to sort of move to slowly as the talk progresses is that in cancer, there's a scrambling of this methylated CGs, and new genes appear for the first time that were never on before in the cancer, and new genes are and old genes are turned off in the cancer. Right? And it has an impact on the cancer. So not all of the origins of cancer are due to genetic changes. Some are due to epigenetic changes. In other words, your cancer is not quite the tissue from which it came. It's something else. Right? And actually, one of the take-home messages is it's going to be an awful lot like embryonic stem cells. Right? A very early stage in which it's wiped clean. Right? Okay. All right. So this experiment, yes?
Is there inherited RNA as well, and does that...
Yes, so many genes, we have about 25,000 genes. About 3,000 or 4,000 of them actually make RNA but not protein. Right? And so the biggest of which is ribosomal RNA, in which proteins are being translated. But there's a lot of small RNAs that are guide RNAs that regulate circuits and things like that. So you don't inherit the RNA, you inherit the DNA that makes the RNA. Right? There are viruses. The only organisms that have RNA as their genetic information are a whole subset of viruses, some of which make a DNA copy. They're called retroviruses, some of which don't. They make RNA into RNA. And there's actually a very interesting consequence of that. Influenza is an RNA into RNA virus, and the fidelity of copying RNA into RNA is very bad. 1 in 10 to the fourth errors, right? The frequency of fidelity of 10 to the minus 4th, while the frequency of fidelity of DNA replication would be about 10 to the minus 8th. Right. And this poor fidelity means lots of different viruses are made, they have lots of mutations, and they survive your immune system, and that's why you get flu every year, right? Because they keep changing. Right. Okay, so this is Gurdon's experiment in the 60s. And experiments like this lie dormant for a very long time until about 6 or 7 years ago, when Yamanaka in Japan decided to try to do a different kind of experiment. He, instead of starting off with a frog's egg, he started off with what's called a fibroblast. Right? So fibroblast is a cell that makes lots of collagen. It'll help make your tendons. It'll help make your fibrous material in your skin. It fills your body with fibrous materials. It's a support cell. And it's easy to take out of people. You just get a skin biopsy, and you put it in cell culture. So he did it with mice and with humans. And the cell largely looks like this. It has a nucleus. And he asked the question, could I change that fibroblast in some way into an embryonic stem cell? An embryonic stem cell is back here, and it will make a whole tadpole. So a single embryonic stem cell put in the right environment makes a tadpole. So he's now asking a slightly different question. Now, let me sort of bring you up to date. All of the stem cell biology that people like to talk about, and California has a big bond issue about stem cell biology, it uses embryos. Mouse embryo, human embryos, it takes these cells and they can differentiate into many tissue types, and the hope was it could regenerate the tissue types, right? That was the hope, right? There's a big barrier, immunological barrier, in that if I took stem cells from you and tried to use them on you, you would reject them because you reject his tissues as foreign. So there's an immunological barrier about that. I have to stay within the person, and I have to get the eggs. So I'd have to get the eggs from the wife, then I'd have to get the fertilized eggs, then I'd get these cells, and then it'd go back into the husband, right? And he would probably reject it because he rejects his wife, right? So it wasn't a really good idea, but when you did it with inbred animals, you were fine if you didn't have an immunological barrier. This was an attempt to get over this problem. Because I can take fibroblasts from anybody. And if I could change them into embryonic stem cells, I would be in great shape to then take your own cells make a stem cell, put it back into you, and you could regrow neurons, or you could a whole bunch of things. In fact, that was done in rats, and there was a very famous experiment in a rat where the spinal cord was severed, and then they put stem cells back in, and it regrew neurons, and the paralysis in the hind legs actually wasn't perfect, but it was ameliorated, right? So there was hope for this thing. So what Yamanaka did, which was really quite amazing and quite interesting, was he found four proteins, actually add back the genes, but he found the four proteins which, when he added to the cells, made embryonic stem cells. Now, I'm just going to give you the names of those proteins. It won't mean much to you until I start to describe them. MYC, KLF4, SOX2, and OCT4. So these first two turn out to be oncogenes. That means that when overexpressed, they make the cell divide. And that was turned out to be a very important part of reprogramming a fibroblast into a stem cell. You had to get the division rate up high, so you're using genes that cause cancer to get the rate up high, right? And then SOX2 and OCT4 are reprogramming cells. They're really transcription factors. They bind to DNA, right? So they'll bind to this DNA, right? And they'll reprogram them by taking off the methyl group, right? They'll subtract out the methyl group. So they're reprogramming the DNA by taking these methyl groups off, right? And so this is oncogenes, these are reprogramming genes. And then you erased all the marks, or most of the marks, not all of them, and you got something that looked like an embryonic stem cell. In fact, you could put it back into the mouse case, you could put it back into the mouse, and it would contribute to all of the germ cell layers of the mouse. It would make skin, it would make muscle, it would make bone, it would make intestine, it would make pancreas, right? So it actually was quite amazing that you could start off with one mouse, a fibroblast, you could put in just four of these reprogramming factors and replication factors, and you'd make these stem cells. Now, they weren't exactly like embryonic stem cells for a couple of reasons, right? One is they actually didn't totally reprogram, they partially reprogrammed. So they came to be called induced pluripotent stem cells. But that's just, these are quasi-equivalent to embryonic stem cells, and they do contribute to the new mouse that's being made. Now, they had a lot of problems, actually. First of all, when you have two oncogenes, that mouse developed cancer very rapidly. Right? So there was no mouse that got away with not having cancer, but at least you knew what was happening, even though the experiment wasn't viable or workable for humans. Secondly, there was a real problem, and the efficiency with which this happened was about 0.1%. One in about 1,000 cells that you did the experiment with actually came through, and the timing was terrible. It took anywhere between 6 weeks to 3 months. Right? So the timing was terrible, the kinetics were terrible. Nobody liked the experiment, but it was a remarkable experiment that you could reprogram back from any cell in the body, right? But what
3 months was for the get 0.01?
The 3 months was for the 0.1% to emerge and be able to be put back in the mouse.
It would be half a day, right? If it were running 1,000.
A million, yeah. If you ran a million, no, it would still take 3 months. It was a kinetic barrier. There were certain things that had to happen over time. It was a poorly efficient, is the right way to put it.
This set is not unique.
This set of genes has been fairly unique. It is the most efficient one so far. Now, let me say, once you find four, there are a lot of genes like this. People went back to their lab to find the better set, right? Let's get the efficiency up, let's get the time down, let's get it. Everybody started working on it once everybody, Why? Because if you can get rid of the cancer genes, if you can do it efficiently, then I could take anyone in the audience and reprogram you, right? And I can even put these cells back. And maybe this will even make you live longer if you get more stem cells, right? I mean, there were a lot of imaginations running, right? And of course, that will drive people back into the lab day and night to try to figure out, how do I make this more efficient, right? So this happened about 6 years ago, right? And 2 years ago, in the summertime, four papers got published in Nature simultaneously. Like anything else, what happens in our field is that simultaneously four independent groups came to the same solution of how to speed this up, how to get it going, how to make it work, right? Each group thinks the other group stole it, but that's exactly, that happens, I'm sure, all the time, right? So 2 years ago, they found out that you could, if you started off with a fibroblast that didn't have a gene, a particular gene, whose name I like a lot because it's a gene that we found in my lab called P53. So if you didn't have this gene, now you could get rid of MYC and KLF4, which is great because you're getting rid of the oncogenes. And all you need now is SOX2 and OCT4. And first of all, the efficiency of making an embryonic stem cell went up to 80%. Well, so that's pretty good. And the time went down to 6 days. So they solved all the problems except one. And that is what had substituted was, by getting rid of two oncogenes, they had substituted the loss of something that prevented cancer. Right? So this was...
Was that a group in UCLA who did that?
No, it wasn't. Not that I know of. But no. I mean, they might have been the fifth group or the sixth group or the seventh group, but yeah. You know how many people published in the second round that said that they were being screwed in the first round and all things like that. So in any case, this is what attracted our attention, right? Is why is it that losing something, right, gives rise to good efficiency of reprogramming, right? And the simplest interpretation was this something enhances the stability of the program. It enhances stability or fidelity of the program. It keeps a liver cell a liver cell. And it also prevents cancer that way. Right? So it's a kind of interesting idea that the developmental issue carries over to the disease processes because this is the stability factor. Right? And even more interesting was there was a mechanism that could be proposed and looked at, and that is that it was well known that you could methylate this protein by some of the same enzymes that methylate other proteins that are important in the program. So there was communication between methylation enzymes and the enzyme, this protein that prevented stem cells from arising, right? Now, preventing stem cells from arising is actually pretty important. You would not like it if, having had lunch, everybody, right, your liver cells started changing into heart cells, right? Or if they started drifting off and become something else, right? So there's an active prevention of loss of the program. And what we know so far is this is one of the genes that actively prevents it. And we could demonstrate that rather easily in our lab because we had mutations of this gene which we could turn on and off, right? So these were called temperature-sensitive mutations. They functioned as the normal protein at 32 degrees centigrade, but at 39 degrees centigrade, they were abnormal, right? So at 39, we made 80% of the cells like this. If at any time we turned it to 32, we stopped the process, right? So we really could show rather clearly that this was actively preventing the process. And we could show there were two steps that actively prevented the process. Part of it was it prevented the replication of the cell, and part of it was it prevented the methylation, right? Where's my methylation? The methylation of the DNA, right? Now, we could show it another way that's quite interesting. So we have, a long time ago, others and we made a mouse that didn't have this gene, right? Now, we do that all the time. We knock the gene out, so the mouse is born without the gene. And this mouse, with 100% efficiency, develops cancer in a 3 to 6 month period. That's because of the lack of stability that it's giving rise to. But even more important is the mouse also gives rise to animals that have birth defects. And those animals with birth defects don't have the methylation in a proper way. Right? So we could demonstrate that this is important for the stability of this methylation. Right? And it was at that point, right, at this point, this is a bad point, but because it's late, right, that we realized that the same thing could happen in cancer. And the reason is that in about 60% of all cancers, this P53 gene is mutated. Right? And that suggested a relationship between the program in development and its stability and what was happening as cancers develop. That they may change their program and change their properties of their cells, right? And to put it in the parlance of the field, there were epigenetic changes seen in cancer. These epigenetic changes could be causative of the fact that the cancer becomes very aggressive. Okay? So we wanted to hypothesize, and this now I'm going to switch into work done on a completely theoretical level at the Institute for Advanced Studies by Elke Mockett, who's right here, right? And we hypothesized that maybe those cancers that have this epigenetic change and those cancers that make the cell look like an embryonic stem cell, if they look like that, by look like it, I mean what? The transcripts of the genes are those of the embryonic stem cell. The methylation changes are very plastic. They can go in many directions, right? Developmentally, right? If that happened, if I had a cancer that had an embryonic stem cell transcriptional profile, and by profile I mean the first 500 messenger RNAs look like an embryonic cell, not like the liver cell it is, or not like the prostate cell it is, right? But that might be a bad outcome, a really bad outcome. Now, this also had this idea, which was testable, right? We could look for P53 mutations and then ask, were they the worst outcomes, and did they look like embryonic stem cells when we looked at the profile of messenger RNAs made by the tumor, right? That's the experiment. That's all testable and nice. But it also had a very practical and important outcome that you'll see why we chose prostate cancer. Right? So a curious thing happened in the late 1970s, early 1980s. A test for prostate cancer in the blood got developed. Everybody knows it as the PSA test. And everybody thought this was terrific because while prostate cancers lie dormant for a long period of time, now with a blood test, you could go in and test whether or not the prostate was actively producing a protein called PSA, prostate-specific antigen. And if it was, then they go back in and take a hard look at whether you had prostate cancer. The hard look was a biopsy, and the biopsy never really worked well, so you had to do 6 or 8 biopsies. And then the pathologist would read it and wasn't sure. But whatever it was, it threw a lot more men into the mill, right? So what happened in the United States was the frequency with which they were, incidence with which they were diagnosing prostate cancer doubled in the late 70s, early 80s. It doubled, right? Meaning that there were an awful lot of people who had never complained about prostate cancer who suddenly were getting called as prostate cancer positive, right? However, the death rate, as people began to look at this, the death rate from prostate cancer stayed exactly the same as it was, even though that the incidence doubled, right? No, half of the same number of people died. It looked like half the people were, yeah, right. Looked like half the people were, so it looked like we were doing a great job because we were saving more, right? Yeah, but we weren't saving more. We were just diagnosing more that weren't going to die in the first place, right? And even worse, people who were diagnosed were younger. They were in their 50s and 60s, and no one knew how to treat them. Because in the past, the average age of diagnosis was 72. Now the average age diagnosis dropped to 60, right? And as soon as you heard you had prostate cancer, you ran to the doctor. You had a radical prostatectomy, right? That the side effects were impotence and incontinence, right? Which is bad enough. Then you started taking anti-androgen therapy, and then after that you started taking chemotherapy, right? And only 7 to 11% of people were dying of prostate cancer. And yet 60 to 70% of people being treated for prostate cancer. Right? This was a full employment act for the prostate cancer docs, right? They doubled their population size and nobody died, but everybody got treated, right? So it was a little bit like breast cancer, where they decided that radical mastectomies were an important thing. They tried that for a while, and then they found out that lumpectomies were just as good, and that you could cut back on chemotherapy. I mean, the take-home message is that when you look carefully, there are indolent cancers that don't kill anybody, that treated mildly is fine, and then there are really bad cancers. And wouldn't it be great if we could tell the really bad from the indolent? And so we made the hypothesis that anyone who had embryonic stem cell transcriptional profile would have a bad cancer. Right? The outcome. And we came across a wonderful data set. It's an experiment never to be repeated. It was done in Sweden, and it was started in the 1970s before the PSA test. So these are people who are in their 70s. They're not diagnosed by PSA. And they formed a group. The Swedes understood in their wisdom that, in fact, it would be better not to treat these people. So they formed a group of 281 men that they called the watchful waiting group. No treatment. You're diagnosed with prostate cancer, shake your hand, send you home, say, come back every 6 months. You don't feel well, come back in 3, right? The watchful waiting cohort went 30 years, 26 years, something like that, right? And so you could see the outcome of a natural disease with no treatment, right? So the first thing that happened was between 7 and 11% of the watchful waiting cohort died of prostate cancer. Right? And that meant 90% died of other things. Died of heart disease, died of a wide variety of elderly diseases. Right?
Stage of a diagnosis, it was a 2, stage 2, stage 3. What stage was diagnosed initially?
These are diagnosed at all stages, actually. So, but they tend to be late stages. They tend to be late. Why? Because they're not picking it up by PSA. They're picking it up by physical examination, which tends to be a larger later state. But there was no grade that was imposed. It just was the natural history of the disease. It could have been that someone came in, was examined, and they picked up early. So we have all grades and all stages. Okay. So we could get those prostate cancers. We could get the messenger RNAs from those prostate cancers. This is 281 men, right? And we could look at the genes that they expressed, right, the messenger RNA profiles, and we could match them up to embryonic stem cell profiles, right? And with a p-value of about 10 to the minus fifth, right, these people who died of prostate cancer had embryonic stem cell profiles, right? In fact, the standard way to look at this is you draw a curve where you have percent survival, and you have years. And what's great about this is this goes out 30 years, right? And we could recognize by looking at the messenger RNAs, we could recognize 5 different groups. I'm just going to draw 2 groups. Right? We recognized one group of which they died of other things. Let's say heart disease. Right? This is like, I have a friend who was diagnosed with prostate cancer. So he got very nervous. He called me up and he said, can you get me a really good doc to take a look at me? I got him his best doc I know, and he went in. And it was a week later, he called me up and he said, I want to thank you very much. And I said, why? He said, this doctor told me I'm going to die of heart disease. I mean, he was good enough to recognize you're going to die of something, and it wasn't going to be his prostate cancer, right? So that group, you know, what it was there was a something in the neighborhood of 5 to 10% 5-year survival, right? No, 90 to 95% 10-year survival, right? And then there was another group that at 5 years survival was at 50% and kept going down and down and down, curve that broke. And this was embryonic stem cell, and this was the other.
Right. This is only deaths from prostate cancer.
Yes, and so in this case, because they're diagnosed at 72, it's very important to determine the cause of death, because they're now going out 30 years from, on the average, 72. There's some 65s, but right. So the numbers get weaker and weaker as they move out here, but that's.
How did you have access to whether to find out whether they have embryonic stem cell?
Yeah, so it was in fact years after the fact. So the biopsies were taken, and the biopsies were put into paraffin because the pathologist had a look at it, and the slides were stored. The slides were then taken and the RNA extracted. DNA copies were made and then put on chips, right? The chips had 6,000 genes, and so we could pick up 500 of those genes that were in embryonic stem cells. So it was very fortunate that they, pathologists are required by law to keep the slides. And the reason is that the patient could turn around and sue the pathologist for having read them wrong, right? So they keep the slides for long periods of time, yeah. So we were very fortunate that this is, of course, called a retrospective study, right? I wanted to do this dramatically in different color, yeah. This is a retrospective study, never as good as a prospective study, right? But then we got very really lucky in the following sense. You never want to rely upon 281 men in Sweden. Their genetic background is very narrow. They're all Vikings, you know. I mean, they're just, and so forth. And so we actually then got another data set of 161 men from New York City who were being treated in Sloan Kettering starting in around the year 2000. They only go to 2005 or 6. So there's only a 5-year survival, but we had learned that 5-year survivals were pretty dramatic, right? So we could learn from 5-year survivals. What was quite interesting about them was they're much more heterogeneous. They're mostly European, but they're African Americans. So there's a very great diversity genetically of the group, right? And they had all the material as well. And we looked at it and we could confirm exactly this kind of observation. A few percent of them had, 75% of them who had metastasis at diagnosis had embryonic stem cell, right? That was one indication. PSA, now they're diagnosed all by PSA. Their average age had dropped to about 62 from 72, and yet it didn't matter. We could use the same signals to predict for the future, right? And the ones who had really embryonic stem cell at diagnosis were coming back with metastasis early, and their PSA was returning fast within the 5-year period. The others were latent and long. Okay? So we had two different data sets which are in this range of 7 to 11% who can predict. Right? So now that gave, this is a paper that got published, reviewed and published. And then we went to the place which they have, I mean, it's an amazing place, Johns Hopkins University, where these surgeons who operate on prostate cancer are very renowned and so forth. They see 1,200 patients a year. So the statistics get better. They follow them for a very long period of time. Right? And we can go back in, and we can just take 10 genes from the embryonic stem cell profile and look at the paraffin sections of those genes and ask the question, can we predict? And then we can wait for outcomes in a prospective study instead of a retrospective study, right? So that's a sort of standard way in which you move on, and it's a little bit, I mean, it's a shame because it's a 5-year outcome kind of study, but it hopefully could predict, and that's what I say, could predict who has a bad outcome. Now, what does this actually suggest about cancer? It suggests that cancer evolves as it grows up into a tumor, and in some cases, it changes its imprinting. It changes its epigenetic marks. And new genes appear, which make it very aggressive, sometimes metastatic. Right? And there's a very there's a really good cancer biologist at MIT named Bob Weinberg, who believes, he's got a number of papers suggesting, that there is a epithelial to a mesenchymal transition occurring in cancers. What that means is you're crossing germ layers. Mesenchyme makes muscle and bone, right? And it makes the blood. The blood is very invasive, lots of phagocytosis and movement, right? And it goes from epithelial to mesenchymal transition. Well, that's an epigenetic change, right? And that's a bad prognostic indicator for this. So this history, which goes back to 1960 in effect, and starts the understanding of a second kind of code, if you will. There's the genetic code, which is mutated in cancer, but then there's the epigenetic code, the code that shuts genes down and turns them on and gives you an inherited basis of things and makes tissues what they are. This epigenetic code is violated. And the very same proteins which give stability to the genetic code give stability to the epigenetic code. They resist, that's P53, it resists the change. It's a fidelity factor. Yeah?
Are the profiles correlated with the histological biopsies, the cell?
So I'll do an experiment with you and you'll see why they're not. It's quite interesting. a colon stem cell can be isolated. It may not be the real stem cell, but it's as close, it's somewhere along this line, right? And it's known to be able to make many tissue types, right? And what's quite remarkable about a colon stem cell from a cancer is that as few as 10 of them make a whole cancer again in a mouse, right? There's very few. I mean, usually it takes a million to make a tumor, right? When you look at the tumor that those 10 cells made, right, it's a combination of stem cells and differentiated cells. Right? And so the epigenetic changes are allowing some plasticity in the differentiation pathway within the tumor, but the really important cells are thought to be the stem cells, the cells that metastasize, the cells that are growing, the cells that are really important. And these cells, on average, tend to be resistant to chemotherapy. So that's a problem. And now there's a lot of companies that are trying, for example, to get therapy against stem cells for that reason, because they tend to be more resistant to chemotherapy. So you do see tumors reestablishing. Now, there's a very dramatic experiment with a very bad tumor called glioblastoma. A human glioblastoma was taken, and a marker protein was put into it just to know what the glioblastoma was, right? And that's called green fluorescent protein. It's just a fluorescent marker. And that was put into the brain of a mouse. It was an mouse without an immune system. And the glioblastoma grew up, right? And you look at the glioblastoma and section it, and you look where the green fluorescent protein is, and you suddenly see blood vessels having come into the tumor, and they're green. That suggests that the tumor made the blood vessels, we've always thought of the normal host innervating tumors with blood vessels. Here's a tumor that can make a blood vessel. Blood vessel is a mesenchymal tissue. Right? Glioblastoma is a tumor of the brain. It's an epithelial tissue. Right? And yet it could be that these tumors have crafted a way to be self-sufficient and get new blood vessels in, get that kind of nutrients in and things because of this plasticity. Right? So the literature now is starting to build this notion that this plasticity is not good because it gives the tumor too much leeway. And we have to find a way to take advantage of that and kill it off. Yeah.
Is that as an embryonic stem cell transcription profile somehow correlated to SOX2 or OCT4? I mean, you're suggesting it almost on that.
Yeah. So prior to SOX2 and NOC4, there's a transcription factor called MANOG, which is actually peculiar to this egg and this early embryo and the early embryonic stem cell. It actually, the NANOG is on in this cell type, right? Is NANOG one of your genes? No. In the embryonic stem cell profile.
Some are included. There's several profiles for embryonic stem cells, and they contain, some of them contain, you know, OCT4s in most of them, SOX2, other SOX factors. So it depends on what gene size you choose, how many of those original genes are included in them. But yeah, OCT4 is in most of them.
So I think the problem Elke's bringing up is an interesting question, which we try to test. How many genes make a profile? I mean, you know, there's maybe 6,000 genes in an embryonic stem cell. How many do you have to use to make a profile? So we tried 90, we've tried 300, we've tried 1,000. And by and large, the results are the same. So it's not, so we tended to keep it simple in a subset. But that's one of the variables she's bringing up.
The question is, of course, boiling down to your what you were saying there, that the
is this
the same mechanism.
That's right. Is it the mechanism, or are there other mechanisms? And I think we could learn something from the mechanism the tumors use, and it may even be different for different tumors. Because reprogramming a muscle cell, a rhabdomyosarcoma, may be different than reprogramming a liver cell, may be different than reprogramming a brain cell. So it's kind of interesting possibility to learn from the tumors what we could learn about development. And this whole path, I like this historical path because it shows the close relationship between developmental biology and cancer biology. I mean, we learned a lot from development that we keep applying to cancer. And that's been a very important lesson for us, to know developmental biology. Developmental biology is one of the most remarkable subjects of how you build an organism and how it is maintained, and of which we're getting closer and closer, but probably don't understand many things. Yes?
The methylation process, does it occur at any other stages or just in the...
Oh, it occurs at many stages. So there are different methylases. So there's as you might have expected, if everything's erased here, there's something called the de novo methylase, which starts out with no copies of methyl groups and sees the sequences and lays them down. That's called the de novo methylase. Then there's the reproductive methylase, that's the one I showed you, which when you separate these two strands and replicate them, it copies one strand onto the other. Right? If you eliminate, actually this is a very good example, it shows how P53 works. If it's possible in a mouse to actually have an adult mouse and eliminate the copy methylase. Now that means by two or three generations, you're no longer copying the marks, right? And what happens to that cell? It dies. The cell will actually undergo programmed cell death because it sees that it hadn't copied the marks, and the cause of programmed cell death is P53. So if you knock out P53, it doesn't die, the cell. It becomes aberrant. The liver doesn't function properly, but it doesn't die. So the fail-safe here of not allowing a liver cell to become a heart cell is it kills anyone who is not obeying the rules, essentially. Yes?
So I don't quite understand what prompts the methylation during development.
Yeah.
Because as I understand it, identical twins start out
and have different methylation pattern
and get more different as these marks
with age
accumulate.
Yes.
Why isn't their methylation different from the very start?
So I'll tell you how that's interpreted. What I'm going to say is probably best understood as an interpretation, not a fact, right? So there is a pattern to the methyl patterns, right? It is the frequency with which you see methyl groups. It is the context of other proteins binding to the nucleosomes, binding to the DNA. You get methyl patterns in, okay? So there's a pattern to it. But then there's a stochastic aspect to it. Occasionally you'll miss a methyl group, and then it's not copied properly, right? Two identical twins go through so many divisions that it's not surprising that there isn't, at some low frequency, even 10 to the minus fifth frequency, differences in methyl patterns, because there are lots of methyl, CPG methyl groups. And then there's environmental effects. So methyl groups are one carbon groups. One carbon metabolism depends upon folic acid, a vitamin B. Right? Just changing your folic acid content, just changing the diet you have, can alter the efficiency with which you're reproducing methylation. Right? So there, that's an example of nutritional variation. There's other kinds of variation that can occur with stresses, infections, those kind of things. Often, if you have an infection of the liver and a lot of the liver dies off and then grows back, the patterns aren't quite identical anymore. So there's a strong environmental impact on these patterns. And some people believe this is part of the aging process, right? Is that you're changing over time, and you've gotten to the point where your liver thinks it's something else, and maybe you're in trouble, right? Depending on how much you drink, actually, this may be an important variable, right? So you change over time. That's just the entropic effects of and stochastic effects of time, right? And the efficiency with which we do this is not perfect. That's for sure.
Yeah. There's a hypothesis that tumors might have stem cells hidden in them which are immortal, whereas many of the other cells are not immortal. Your embryonic stem cells, if there's metastasis, do you envision that they are actually the cancer stem cells of the metastatic tumor?
That would be the hypothesis. It's a hypothesis we hadn't proven, right? The way to prove it is to compare metastases with tumor, right? And then look at the transcription patterns and say, oh, these guys are related. I can tell that it's genes that are on are the same, right? And there are very few examples. We got a few of those examples, but very few. Yeah, but yeah, there are ways to test your idea. It's just it gets harder and harder. And the reason is that prostate metastases tend to go to bone. A surgeon would not remove metastasis from bone. It would be too debilitating and... So you try to kill it in the bone, not remove it, not biopsy it, not...
Yeah. So a related question. There are also tissue-specific stem cells, like follicles,
right.
Have a few remaining. But do they have the same...
I could take your fibroblasts out this week.
Yeah.
And by Friday, you could pay for a hair transplant.
So do they have the same transcriptional profile?
No. No. So let's say this is an embryonic stem cell, right? And it would divide a number of times. This is this lesson we've been trying to talk about in the course a lot, right? It would divide a number of times till it got to something that I'd call a progenitor cell, right? So in your hair follicle, it will be the follicle cell itself which can regenerate, or which dies, one or the other. In chemotherapy, that stem cell dies, and you lose your hair. But it's repopulating that progenitor cell, and it may be, right? These progenitor cells are the ones that make have real specificity. Skin, right? There's something called a bulge cell. Colon stem cells have been isolated recently. A whole variety of different kinds of stem cells are in the hunt. But they tend to be these progenitor cells, which are very committed. They would have already made the epigenetic changes for the lineage, right? So they're lineage-specific stem cells. And the more plastic stem cell is back here, and truly would be called embryonic, and maybe somewhere in here is an induced pluripotent stem cell that may be a little less than this guy, but on the progenitor pathway for several progenitors. So unfortunately, the term stem cell is used in multiple contexts that move along developmental lines. Yeah.
Did you try this for other cancers or prostate?
Yes, breast. Well, actually, Alexi and Elke have seen this in all cancers except two. So there are cancers where this does not behave this way. This is not an important issue in colon. It's not an important issue in ovarian. But for whatever reason, it may be that it's yet to be found. But there are many other cancers, maybe 10 other cancers that you've looked at. I don't know what the number is, but... There are many other cancers, eight, in which this seems to hold up for over what's called, there's different ways to measure survival, oddly enough, but what's called overall survival. Yes?
The early stages of this development, how do these epigenetic factors arise?
Yeah, so it's a bit of the sequence context. So if I was to draw, this is a kind of interesting heterogeneity. If I was to draw a chromosome, right, and I had a gene here, genes come in these flavors of exons which are going to become the protein or the message. Just upstream from them, I'd find a lot of CGs. Which gives me the chance to methylate them, and if I choose to methylate them in a particular tissue, it closes down the whole gene. And it has, there are really strange things, like it has some directionality. So it may close this gene down, but open up this gene, moving in the other direction from the other strand. So there's a lot more to this than the simple code of methylating. But this very methylation step is a step that brings in proteins that wrap the chromosome so that it's not available to the RNA polymerase to make message. So it's a wrapping problem. And actually, you can even see that in the nucleus. There are regions which are called heterochromatin, which are shut down, regions called euchromatin, which are opened up and transcribed. And this has this is methylating in every case, these high methylation regions. And there's ways to detect this. There's ways to show what methylation changes occur. And as I say, there are some people who believe, this is an interesting hypothesis, that this kind of turning genes on and off is a way for you to learn something. If you want to commit something to long-term memory, you would open up something that you had closed down, right? As an opportunity. And it makes, of course, you different from me and to what you've learned that I haven't, right? And that suggests that the brain is really sort of using this technique to learn, right? How do you manipulate this, reprogram it, run electrical activity through the axons and the dendrites, but for whatever reason, this then turns on new gene expression patterns which allow neurons to make dendrites and connections they wouldn't have otherwise. And people
you say choice to methylate, you're talking about environmental.
Yeah, I'm even suggesting that just as your immune system would learn that it got infected by a virus, by one way, you would learn that you've gotten new pieces of information by changing these patterns, right? In the brain, though. And that's a hypothesis, not a fact, because it's hard to know exactly where you're recording the information and look at those methyl groups. But in general, people have seen methylation changes in the brain. I'll give you a very good example. There are people who do experiments on depression in animals, right? since we're talking about men here, well, I'll use the particular example. If you put two male mice in a cage, right, with a female at the next cage, so they could smell her, right? They fight until one is dominant and the other is recessive, right? That's just the way life is, right? And the recessive one actually shows the clinical depression. Right? It will not explore the cage. It will sit on the side of the cage. You could look in the cage and know who won and who lost, right? Right? And if you look at methylation patterns in proteins and DNA in the clinically depressed guy, it's different than the winner, right? And that those are the kinds of things that lead to the idea that over time, an environmental effect can have an epigenetic effect in the central nervous system, which has then a behavioral effect that you see, right? And of course, if that is the clinical path, if that's true, then we have to learn how to get that mouse back, right? In that case, right?
We get the criminals from methylation patterns.
For example, the jails are overcrowded here in California.
Yeah.
Going back to the mouse, trying to make the new mouse out of the cell.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. So to do the reprogramming, you have to turn off P53. After you've done the reprogramming, can you turn it back on?
Yeah, you can. And so that's been a very interesting, if you turn it on the right concentrations, that's been a very interesting idea. And it's easier to do that, of course, by drug than it is to do it by genetic manipulation, because you can't do the genetic manipulation in human. So there's been a search for a small molecular weight drug that will turn it off transiently and then turn it back on. And when you turn it back on, one of the things it does is kill a few cells. And presumably it's killing the cells that are on the path to become tumors. And that actually is what you see. It's quite an amazing thing. So P53 not only follows the epigenetic marks, it follows DNA damage. So if I take, I have a mouse and I could turn it on and off, that's genetically in this case, not a drug, right? I turn it off. I irradiate the mouse. Now the mouse has got damage all over the place, and normally that would cause cancer, right? And the mouse starts forming a cancer. I turn it back on, and it clears the cancer, right? So the idea of returning it to a cancer cell has been a real dream for which we don't efficiently have a mechanism of returning it, right? But it also saves you from radiation poisoning. The reason why you are poisoned by radiation is the death of your bone marrow. And this is the protein that kills your bone marrow trying to protect you. Right? It sees damage, it kills cells, and you lose your bone marrow cells. And then you have no immune system for a while until you grow it back up. Right? So this is the reason why chemotherapy is pretty toxic. You lose your hair because of that. You lose in radiation, right? And it would not surprise you that the Department of Defense is looking for a similar kind of mechanism to protect soldiers against radiation on the battlefield. Why? Because then they can continue to fight. However, the problem is at the other end. If you can't reverse it, you got a problem.
You said that this methylation works by some protein sitting on top and kind of closing the gene or so. Well, that's what I understood.
Yes.
Can you disable that protein that reads the methylation?
Yes.
And then you go also back to stem cell type?
It's lethal if you truly disable it from the beginning.
No, but if you do it in cell culture.
If you do it in cell culture, the cells need to divide several times. And that once they divided several times, they no longer pattern the methylation, right? So they failed to make methyl groups. That scene is wrong, and now the cell is killed.
No, I mean, you said that there's proteins that basically you, not that duplicate that, but the ones that, to shut off this gene, it works by proteins sort of physically wrapping around.
That's correct.
Right?
So if you get rid of those proteins, it's just the same as
that. It should be just the same as the non-methylated gene.
Yes, yes. And that also is seen as a significant change. And you'll either get abnormal gene expression, which will be benign, or the cell will die, one or the other, depending on how significant the gene is and the changes.
Okay,
thank you. Yes, you're right.